I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to On Brand with Alf and me, Rory Sutherland. Each month I'll be talking to household names and challenger brands about success, challenges and future opportunities in the advertising, marketing and media industries. Today I'm joined by Simon Peel, who's Vice President of Global Marketing at Haleon, a consumer health company. Now, for those of you who don't know, Haleon was born out of three consumer health businesses from GSK, Novartis and Pfizer. In July 2022, Haleon demerged and was listed as an independent company on the London and New York Stock Exchanges. Although Haleon itself is a young company, some of its brands have over 170 years' worth of history, and much of its portfolio are household names you're no doubt familiar with, from Sensodyne to Voltarol to Centrum, Advil, and many, many more. While Haleon has just agreed the sale of the iconic lip balm ChapStick brand, it has also launched 52 products in 2022 alone, and last year's UK media spend hit £53 million. 2024 is going to be a very interesting year for what is a both a new and an old company in the whole field of consumer health and marketing. So, Simon, huge welcome to the podcast. And we'll always start with this, but tell us about your career path or journey, or however. I never describe mine as a career path. It's too random for that. But how did you get where you are today? Put it that way.
All right. Well, firstly, thank you very much for inviting me on. It's a real pleasure. So thank you. It's not a massively exciting story to tell, unfortunately. So I started out in media agencies. When I left university, like a lot of people, I didn't really know what to do. When I was at university, I went and did an internship at Total Media, who were based in Kensington in London. And within Total Media, they had an arm that was specifically focused on record labels and providing media planning and buying to the to the music industry. So I thought that was pretty fun. There seemed to be like quite young and vibrant people in that industry, so it seemed like a good place to go after university. Anyway, after university, so I must have done the internship whilst at uni. So after university, I joined a media agency called Mindshare. They are part of WPP. I was there for a couple of years. Then I joined another WPP company called Mediacom, where I was there for about 5 or 6 years. And then I was at PhD, another media agency. And then I went client side. I was a bit frustrated with not being able to affect things as much as I would have liked. So I went to 20th Century Fox to work on their theatrical releases across EMEA, and headed up media there and worked in the advertising department. So they had a lovely building in Soho, like that, lovely cinemas. I think it's closed down now, but it was a wonderful place. Absolutely fantastic.
I remember this. Yeah, I actually remember it. Yeah. I mean, funnily enough, in the creative agencies, the whole world has never been quite as much fun since the media people left, and for two reasons. The media people were generally more fun and more sociable to begin with, but also you were, when you had media in-house, you were actually a purchaser, not only a supplier. So you did have access to some forms of entertainment. People were actually interested in you turning up, which I think is something which creative agencies, obviously, you know, you no longer really have photographers as key suppliers. So you're pretty much 100% of your time effectively groveling to people rather than being groveled to. I jokingly said to another colleague of mine, Annette King, that actually going into hospital for 3 days when you work in a creative agency is in a weird way quite welcome, because for a change, they're making a fuss of you rather than you making a fuss of somebody else. But no, it was that, by the way, it was a glorious time to be there. And of course, Mediacom, you probably remember all the people like Sue Uneman and so forth who were there at the time, I expect, were they?
And Sue's a lovely lady. She was the head of strategy. She's wonderful. I mean, very strategic, very clever. She's still there. I think she's now at the agency that they've created that sort of goes in between Mediacom and Essence. So obviously they're now called Essence Mediacom. And I think they've created another agency for competitors. So Sue heads up that. Brilliant lady.
Yeah, absolutely right. It was really a fun. And actually, the whole ecosystem was just fascinating at the time. So you could actually have some sort of subjective conversations, which was always nice, rather than this slight mythology of the data will tell us what to do, which really worries me now. Not because the data doesn't sometimes tell you what to do, but because it shortcuts that need to ask wider questions. You know, I think we get to the answer too quickly.
Yeah, I think the data is often misleading, isn't it? It's like anything with these sorts of things. If you've already got a predisposition to find something, you're going to find it. Within that data, I think it's kind of the opposite of the scientific method, where you're trying to disprove yourself. Often in these types of things in advertising, you're trying to prove yourself, and the data helps you. So, if you've got this sort of leaning towards the data, I think you'll find it, and then it's very dangerous because it kind of reinforces biases that you've already got.
So there are probably several compounding biases, which is, you know, click through rates, for example, or engagement. Are very easy to measure, whereas wider engagement is hard. But also there's the fast-slow problem. There's data in acquisition, which emerges immediately, whereas data in retention is really, really slow. Data acquisition data is clean. Data retention data is obviously noisy, because in between the stimulus and the results coming in, a lot of other things have happened. So attribution becomes more difficult. So we get absolutely focused with, there was someone at the Department of Transport I was talking to yesterday who said she'd previously worked for an economist who just continually reminded her, said, our job is to quantify what's important, not to deem important what we can quantify. And I think, you know, that's a lesson for all of us all the time. And as I'm quite fond of saying, all big data comes from the same place, the past. So it heavily biases you towards what happened to be the case previously rather than what could be the case in the future. So I think that it's really, really interesting.
Yes, that's true. And also it's often short-term data as well, because we have a bias towards things that I think it's called, I can't remember what it's called, but the relevance or how close it is, the data. So it's more memorable and stands out in your mind. It's more salient. So because short-term data is often more accessible, it's a quicker proof point, and therefore it tends to be the one that you lean more heavily towards rather than long-term data.
So you went client-side to 20th Century Fox, and then where after that?
So after 20th Century Fox, I went to Adidas. So at 20th Century Fox, basically you either move to LA or you move on. So my wife at the time and I didn't really want to move to LA. So we moved to Adidas based in Germany. And actually, I joined their procurement department. So their marketing procurement, and they were looking for a director of media procurement. And I knew that Adidas didn't have a media department. So I thought if I got in there and convinced the right people that they would build a media department around this kind of idea that I had. And I remember Adidas it used to be a fantastic advertiser. In 2012, it did a brilliant campaign related to the Olympics, which were in London at the time. They had a number of London Underground stations with posters of athletes that were going to compete in the London Olympics. And it was such a great campaign. But then I remember not seeing anything particularly good from them for a couple of years. So I thought that if I could get in there, I could try and encourage them to, certainly when it comes to advertising, to get back to some of that better quality work. Anyway, I went in, there was a big procurement project, which is all about savings. And I kind of did the opposite. The consultant that was in there was trying to save hundreds of millions through stupid little tactics. And essentially what I said was, actually, we're not paying the agency properly. We're focused on the wrong KPIs. We've got an opaque model, and we should be much more focused on creativity and effectiveness. Now, that didn't go down so sweetly in procurement, but it went down very well in marketing. So the marketing guys took notice, and after about 6 months, they hired me to be the global head of media. And I did that and procurement together, so marketing and finance, for about 2 years until someone in procurement took over from me.
That actually, it's worth digressing at this point by saying that procurement, marketing and media procurement done well is a joy. It's one of those things where bad procurement is absolutely catastrophic. So one of the issues, and I thought this was confined to media and advertising until I was talking to someone a couple of days ago who actually does legal procurement. They actually effectively sell legal services to health services, interestingly. And he said that the huge problem is that they are obsessed with achieving comparison. They need their bidders to be comparable so they can then do a price comparison. Okay, and he said the biggest way we can add value is to say, we're going to charge the same price, but you need less of what we're selling. You don't need as much as what we're selling, so we can save you money by buying less. And they always come back and they say, we're not interested in that. Can you please quote for the same quantity at a lower hourly price? And he says, but that's not my point. My point is that it's not that you're spending too extravagantly, it's that you're spending too much. And they go, yeah, but if you quote for the same hourly price at a lower volume to achieve the same end, we can't compare you with the other companies bidding.
I think it's definitely true that effectiveness and efficiency get misconstrued, particularly in finance, where there's a need to chase ROI or looking at short-term savings KPIs. And there's a belief that has a positive effect on the brand or the company, and often it doesn't. So people think they're doing the right thing, but actually they're just doing things right. And that's probably true of GSK. It was kind of notorious in the advertising industry for focusing on cost rather than effectiveness.
The rumor I heard was that GSK's kind of marketing procurement project was called Project Ivy because it's where they imagined we had lunch every day.
That's so funny if that's the case.
Yeah, I definitely heard that as a word on the street, yeah.
Yes, but actually one of the reasons I joined Haleon was the CMO, a terrific lady called Tamara Rogers. So she was one of the big drivers of me going to GSK, or Haleon as it is now. But the other one was actually its previous reputation. And I know this sounds ridiculous, but they had such a notorious reputation for being cheapskates, like essentially trying to cut costs at any cost. So my vanity kind of made me think, well, I can go in there and change that. I can get them to focus much more on effectiveness and growth. So those are the two things that encouraged me to go most, was Tamara being a fantastic CMO, and then to see whether I could take on the challenge of moving a company that's so focused on efficiency and moving them to one that's focused on effectiveness.
I mean, the argument goes even wider than this, if you want to take it really wide in healthcare, which is my question of what's wrong with the placebo effect, okay? Which is that psychological factors in many areas of healthcare, not all, okay, but particularly in terms of pain management, psychological factors are actually a major factor. Now, what tends to happen to prove the pharmacological efficacy of something? They do a randomized controlled trial with a placebo, and they subtract placebo effect from overall effect and declare that is the efficacy of the product. Now, my argument is they're combinatorial, they're multiplicative, okay? You should be seeking to maximize the placebo effect or to make it a multiplier, not to subtract it, okay? Because, I've often said, I always complain that you can't buy expensive aspirin. And I go, look, I haven't got a 50p headache. I've got a £2.80 headache, okay? And things like, you know, undoubtedly painkillers are more effective, just as wine tastes better if you tell people it's expensive. Painkillers are more effective. And also, I was the only person who wanted to defend Nurofen. I know it's a competitor of yours, because they produced more or less identical products for the Australian market, which were called Nurofen for period pain, okay, Nurofen for specific disorders. And then they charged a premium for it. But both the charging of the premium and the specificity, okay, makes the product more effective. The placebo is a wonderful story of this, which is a brilliant anecdotal thing, which appears in this book I'm always recommending called The Experience Machine by Andy Clark, which is all about the peculiarities of human perception in all kinds of ways and how we haven't evolved to have objective perception. And it's a story of a guy who's hammering some nail in with a nail gun and blasts the nail right through his boot. Okay, so his foot is now nailed to the floor. Okay, and he's screaming in complete agony. And so the paramedics come along, cut away his boot. And it's then revealed that by some miracle, the nail has actually bypassed his toes and has actually gone right between the big toe and the adjacent toe. And it hasn't even drawn blood. Okay, right? Okay, it hasn't even cut him. Okay. And this guy was literally screaming in complete agony until the moment they removed his boot and revealed that actually there wasn't even a flesh wound, at which point all the pain went away. So the book, The Experience Machine, which you must give to all your colleagues in Halion, is basically saying that most of what we perceive is a prediction, and we use our senses to error correct for prediction. We don't use our senses to generate information. We use prediction to generate the core information, and then we use the available kind of bandwidth of our senses to, in a Bayesian way, to kind of correct for it. And so the expectation of pain generates pain. Famously, the guy you need to talk to here, by the way, I'll give him a big plug, is Professor Rob Horn at UCL, who's like Mr. Placebo, good Welshman as well, so I'm always keen on that. But he's actually he's Professor Placebo. And he asked exactly the weird same question, which it's not surprising that advertising people ask this question, because we go, what's wrong with intangible value? If you'll pay for it, who cares whether you're paying for the meal or the experience in the restaurant? It doesn't really matter. The extent to which the pleasure was provided by the food, manufacturing, or the environment, marketing, it's senseless to make that kind of, it's a false dichotomy to try and distinguish the two. And so I think, and then by the way, I've got some good heavyweight support for this, because I actually went to a dinner and ended up sitting next to Sir Patrick Vallance, who completely agreed on this point. And he was actually the former chief scientific officer at GSK, if I'm right. Okay. And he said, no, this placebo thing, it's not our enemy. We shouldn't be trying, oh God, it's the bloody placebo effect. We should be going, hey, this placebo effect is great. Let's see how we can magnify it. Because pharmaceutical companies spend big on the scientific research, pharmacological research, as is good and right, okay? But if you acknowledge the fact that this is the two are complementary, not in opposition, you should equally spend big on marketing research. And of course, GSK had this brilliant marketing success, which was Night Nurse, which was a product that treated cold and flu, which unfortunately sent people to sleep, right? And a guy said, look, if you, obviously you can't drive and operate heavy machinery, but if we call the product Night Nurse, I don't know if he came up with a name instantaneously, but he said, if we position this as a nighttime or bedtime cold and flu remedy, the fact that it sends you to sleep isn't a bug, it's a feature, right? That was a brilliant, a genius marketing case of what you might call marketing R&D, which is don't just think about what the product does, think about what else we could make it do. No one is prepared to actually optimize for perception rather than optimizing for reality. And it drives me nuts.
I believe the confectionery industry is doing something with this, aren't they? I think that they've got shrinkflation, where chocolate bars have become something like 15% smaller over the last 10 or 15 years. And I believe it's based on some scientific study that they found that people didn't really notice when things were shortened or decreased in small little increments until sort of 10 years later when they look back and they're like, oh my God, that's totally different to where we came from.
I mean, I think fundamentally, just as in restaurants, understand this instinctively, because if you don't understand it, you're out of business, which is the value is as much in the intangibles as in the product. I was talking to Jay Rayner. I made him a big gaffe by calling Jay Rayner a food critic. And he said, I'm not a food critic. I'm a restaurant critic. So they're totally separate things, which is really, really interesting. He said, oh, I just focus on the food. He said, there are shit restaurants which serve brilliant food. And they're actually brilliant restaurants which serve not shit food, but pretty average food. Okay, right. You know, I think that that's the great problem we've had is our obsession with dividing things into individual components and optimizing the parts makes us blind to what's really going, what effectiveness really means.
Top two challenges brought to you by Alf Insight.
Alf Insight helps media owners, agencies, and marketing service providers improve their new business pipelines by equipping them with in-depth insights, accurate information, and daily news updates on the leading and challenger brands in the UK. Alf now also helps sports clubs, venues, and charities win new partnership deals. Alf Insight identifies the brands to target at the right time, providing everything you need to tailor the perfect pitch. Visit Alf Insight, that's alfinsight.com, or click the link in the episode description to find out more. Two top challenges. So the two challenges are, first of all, it's kind of brand specific. How has Haleon been approaching consumer behavioural changes brought on by the cost of living crisis, i.e. people switching to own brand products and trading down? That's the first top challenge. Ta-da! And secondly, what's the biggest challenge, you think, for the consumer, by which I suppose we mean over-the-counter and DTC, what are the biggest challenges for the overall category as well? How do you see it playing out?
So I think the answers to both of those questions are quite similar, because what happens to Haleon tends to be a representation of the wider market, industry, society. Haleon's a relatively new company, so it was introduced to the markets in July 2023. So for us, or for the organization at the moment, one of the key things is, how do we keep shareholders happy and how do we deliver short-term revenue and results that are going to make them happy? But then how do we do so by also considering that there's a long-term view and we need to build towards that? And I think that's probably the same in, certainly in society, where we're trying to manage these short-term issues at the moment, but then also being cognizant that, you know, there are long-term issues as well, like climate versus the cost of living, as an example, climate being long-term and cost of living being short. So I think, and it's probably the same in the advertising industry as well, you've got a lot of organizations that are trying to grapple with this issue. So they would be the two. I mean, they're basically the same answer. Haleon is grappling with short and long, and I think society and industries are as well.
Yeah.
One of the areas that we've been trying to focus on is an emotional connection, or at least a salience with people. Because obviously you can go out and buy supermarket owned products, but it's about differentiating and being distinctive from those and creating a trust with those brands. You know, we're working in a low interest category,
but it's very high interest when you have a problem.
No one wakes up in the morning with a headache thinking, I've got to go out and get this brand. They're just thinking about paracetamol. But it's kind of our job to make sure that when they are thinking about paracetamol, they do think about us. So,
yes.
And to have that sense of a trusted brand as well, which I don't think you get so much from supermarket owned.
I suppose you have a difficult problem there as marketers, because probably the main return on marketing in this category, which is a need state category, is actually the ability to command and maintain a price premium. And of course, that's harder to prove than incremental sales. So you have again this problem where attribution becomes this driving force. And actually it's massive. It leads to massive quantification bias. I mean, I was talking to someone last night at a dinner who thought that the invention of the spreadsheet had made us all stupider because it forced us to reduce to numbers, either to reduce to numbers things which can't be reduced accurately to numbers or which aren't linear, or it led us just to ignore things that can't be numerically expressed. Because you can't, they don't fit in your spreadsheet.
There's definitely something in that. I know, obviously, there's a huge fashion towards generative AI at the moment. And obviously, that's all based on historical data. So it takes historical data and then creates new generations of it or generative iterations of it. So everything's codified. But there are some things in life that just aren't codified. There's some things that are about soul and connection and... there's a lot of things that we just don't understand, but we have an intimacy towards it. I think the danger with a lot of these things, particularly Excel or AI, is that we buy the insights and this sort of miracle results that they're positioning, and actually they could be reinforcing a bias that we're trying to eradicate or we're trying to address. So I don't know if that's making sense, but definitely there's a problem related to this over codification of data. And, you know, I don't think Excel is the root cause of it, but I think it represents a larger problem, which is that potentially we devalue artistic merit and creativity when we should be valuing it much more.
Yeah, it represents the problem because the guy with the pie chart and the spreadsheet will tend to win an argument over the guy who has the abstract nouns, you know.
Yeah, well, that's just creative and media for you, isn't it? That's basically what I mean.
I always thought, by the way, I still think the separation of creative media was dumb. I think it made sense from a narrow short-term commercial perspective. Did it add value to clients? Absolutely quite the reverse.
But do you think we'll see a change, Rory? Do you think we'll see a reverse?
I would dearly love to see Ogilvy bringing at least media planning partly within the overall process. Yeah, I would dearly love to see that. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's next, Rory. Like bringing Ogilvy and Mindshare back together. It could be the new WPP amalgamation of agencies.
I mean, interestingly, CHI and the AND partnership refused to separate the two. And I would argue that what was crazy was it happened at a time, you could argue a little bit, okay, in the late 80s, early 90s, you could argue, well, we're going to do a TV campaign, so what particular ads are bought is immaterial to the creative development of the ad, okay? Now we're in a world where it's a high-context world, where what you say, who you say it to, and when you say it are all totally interdependent, and actually... The way you get the best answer is to triangulate all three, the when, the who, and the what you say, okay? And therefore, the separation of the two was a massive exercise in value destruction and actually diminished our ability to solve problems. It was done... It's a very common thing in businesses where legibility and neatness of structure from the top, okay, triumph over value creation. People love running a company which is divided into these neat divisions and silos because, you know, it makes comparison and all those things so easy. But actually, the real value is created horizontally. That's the problem. The companies are organized vertically. And as again with Night Nurse, the value was created horizontally, which was effectively a scientific conversation taking place with a marketing mindset.
Have you heard this one? I think it relates, and I'm sure you must have heard it, Rory, but it's the anecdote by Richard Thaler that talks about something called the dumb principle. Have you heard this one?
No, I haven't heard this. I should have done, but yeah.
So Thaler was conducting a workshop with a CEO, and I think it was 23 managing directors or department heads looking after this publishing firm. And they were given this task, which was essentially... or it was a question, would you take a 50-50 bet? And on one side of the 50-50 bet, you stood the chance of winning $2 million. But on the other side, the flip of the coin, you had the potential of losing $1 million. So it's essentially asking these 23 people whether they would take the bet or not. And of the 23, only two said yes. But had all 23 of them said yes, the rules of probability on flipping a coin 50-50 meant that they would have made $11.5 million. But the fact that it was only two that went for the choice meant that the most that they could earn was $4 million. And the point about all of this is organizational silos create vested interests, and those managing directors were too risk-averse to think about the or not incentivized to think about the organization as a whole. They were incentivized to think about their own jobs and their own roles.
You've created these silos, and you've basically created a case where there are basic, I mean, you know, is marketing a cost center or a value creator? Okay. Well, the only obvious answer is it's a bit of both, and but everybody wants to put something into a pocket where it's just treated as a cost. And it's a daft way to frame it. Okay. Because and so that you're absolutely right. By creating these silos and then effectively you drive incrementalism. And you also drive this great book I also recommend, Gillian Tett's book, The Silo. I think it's called The Silo Effect, which is all about this, that silos are valuable in some ways because of specialism, but they also create complete blindness to anything that exists beyond the kind of focus of the silo. And it comes down to W. Edwards Deming, who said,
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
To optimize the whole, you have to sub-optimize the parts. And so most organizations really, so he was the guru of Japanese economic revival. He was an American, Welsh-American, I'm proud to say, but he was an American. I think that Edward the Deming or something was on the Mayflower or something. But he was this extraordinary genius in terms of sort of proper efficiency studies. And he said, if you just optimize the parts, you're sub-optimizing the whole. And so we've created business where the principal, and I blame management consultants for this, the principal activity is based on the assumption that if you optimize the parts, you'll optimize the whole. And it's really, really terrible.
I guess it's easier for management consultants to sell piecemeal, isn't it? Because it's easier to optimize individually and also sell it individually to prove out the effectiveness of those individual products. And then they can do it in the short term and take it to another company and do it again. So I guess that's why it works like that. It's invested to make a short-term profit.
I've got a whole spiel, which I'll happily deliver to Haley at any time you like, which is about that actually, if you look at great inventors, they're actually marketers, okay? Whether it's, you know, Colonel Sanders or Henry Ford or Edison, okay, or James Watt, half their genius went into actually selling the idea. And in medicine, it would include, I always assumed naively that Edward Jenner came up with vaccination. Everybody said, brilliant, Ed, you're a fucking hero. You've solved our smallpox problem, okay? He basically had to spend his whole life effectively fighting for the idea. And there were breakthrough things. I mean, there was an earlier breakthrough where someone called Elizabeth Wortley Montagu persuaded the royal family to be variolated, which is, in other words, exposed to a mild smallpox dose in part of the body, which she'd brought over from Turkey, where her husband had been a diplomat. And her great marketing coup was getting the royal family to adopt it, which then made it kind of automatically respectable. So actually, medical successes are, if you dig them back, I mean, you know, a really fascinating one is called stomach ulcers, which was, it was believed to, apparently in communist China, they all knew that stomach ulcers were bacterial, but nobody took their medicine seriously. And it was this poor Australian guy who ended, you know, who before he got the Nobel Prize was kind of vilified for years for having this dissenting view. And the difficulty there in the breakthrough is it's marketing your idea is actually the difficult part of the problem. Being right is comparatively easy. It's changing people's minds that's the real struggle.
Yeah, so it's interesting that dissenters are often right, aren't they? But they're often the ones that get accused of being wrong, and they have to go up against an organization or systems that are desperate to prove them wrong. And actually... it transpires that those dissenters are the right ones after all.
And I often worry about this because I often think that the most valuable outcome of doing an advertising pitch or indeed a media pitch is that as a byproduct of that process, you might actually come to a more interesting question. Not a better answer to the existing question. You come up with a better question. And if we just efficientize everything with AI and we shortcut the process so we get straight to the answer... Yeah, we've got straight to the answer to the original question, but we've also frozen out the opportunity to ask a better question in the first place.
Really interesting. I think creative testing is having that effect on creative agencies a little. I worry a little bit about testing culture. Firstly, I agree with it. I think it makes a lot of sense. And it's good to test things and see whether things are working or they're not. But the thing that worries me is that it's only kind of short-term returns. We're only looking at whether it's testing versus one region in another in a short period of time. It doesn't look at those effects in the long term, and consequently they may get overlooked.
I mean, a really, really good testing culture which allows for failure and actually silliness is a great, great thing. Okay, I mean, genuinely, one of my arguments would be if you have a product that isn't selling, okay, and people say we're going to cut the price to sell more. I would always say, if I'm in an organization, test that, but also test putting the price up. Now, putting the price up is less likely to succeed, okay, on balance, but if it does succeed, it's a much more valuable discovery that you can put the price up and sell more than the fairly banal discovery of we can sell more by giving it away, which, I mean, it's not really that surprising. And so, yet test the opposite would be a really, really good mantra. And the people who do it well, which include things like Amazon, I don't know if it's a brilliant psychological company, but it looks like a brilliant psychological company because it tests. And Sky, I was talking to someone at Sky last night who'd worked at Sky, and I said, they're really good at behavioral science, I think, because all the things I get from Sky seem really behaviorally optimized to me. And he said, they don't have a behavioral science department. I said, well, how come they're so good? And he said, because they have a testing culture, and it kind of amounts to the same thing. So, I mean, maybe the job of our behavioral science practice isn't actually to practice behavioral science. It's just to encourage a test and learn culture. You know, test the opposite. And a fascinating thing I learned from a guy in performance marketing was that the more things you test, the more progress you make. That's not that surprising, right? But what is surprising is it's supralineal. You'd expect that if you test two or three things, you get some benefits, and then they decrease as you test more and more kind of trivial and silly things. But he said his discovery was it's actually the opposite. It's actually not a law of diminishing returns. It's actually a law of gained returns. And his theory was, he was a really good mathematician who'd ended up effectively in a performance marketing business. He said his theory was that the people who test a hell of a lot also test the silly things, and it's the silly things which are, you know, when I say silly, I'm, you know, they test the counterintuitive things, the surprising things, and it's those things where you get your real payback. So there are organizations like Acardo, which can do long-term, effectively long-term testing because, you know, they have really, really long swathes of data. And they tell me that, you know, I better not give away their trade secrets, but they discover like really small, trivial things that in research don't do very well, that don't really make much economic sense. Well, I can tell you about one, which is the green van, okay, which is nudging people to choose delivery slots where there's already a van delivering nearby. Now, that makes a monumental difference to their business because a hell of a lot of people are totally undecided. I mean, all day, I don't really care whether the Ocado guy comes at 3 or 6. And if there's a green van at 6 o'clock, you go, bingo, you've made my choice easier. I'll go for the green one. And again, you know, it's one of those things where really small things can have a huge, huge effect. And luckily, Ocado, of course, have the ability to measure it. And I, to be honest, I might spend but you're absolutely right, which is you have the short-term bias, which is things that at the bottom of the funnel things win over top of the funnel things. I know the funnel isn't really a funnel, but I'm using it as a handy metaphor, etc. Okay. And so you get that and all, but equally, I mean, I think often people, you need imagination and hypothesis before you test. Okay, because otherwise you go mad.
Well, you also need to build it the long term, don't you, in the testing culture? Because otherwise, by very nature, everything will prove out the most short-term result. So you'll never know what's necessarily going to work in the long term because you're not measuring it.
There's probably an interesting case where Amazon, which doesn't make many mistakes, but I think it might have made a mistake with choice architecture over Amazon Marketplace because they've assumed that everybody likes maximal choice, okay, as an assumption. And actually, one of the great values of a physical retailer is curation. You know, if this is... We won't stock this unless it's reasonably repeatedly popular. Now, there is a bit of good news. You know, things like loyalty cards. Ocado, quite rightly, I don't think I'm giving away a secret here, but Ocado and likewise people with loyalty cards make a distinction between products which sell to a lot of people infrequently and products which a few people buy very regularly, okay? So there's a Korean hot sauce where every time I order from Ocado, I order 2 bottles of this Korean hot sauce. Now, they're not going to get rich on the back of this sauce, okay, because not that many people are into Korean hot sauce. But on the other hand, it's my reason for doing the whole shop at Ocado is I run out of this stuff and I know I can get it at Ocado and it would take me, and I couldn't find it somewhere else. So they understand that difference between, you know, many people doing something occasionally and a few people doing something a lot, which is a really important distinction. Now, obviously, the first data emerges quickly. A lot of people doing something once emerges quite quickly, you know, and a few people doing something frequently and repeatedly is much slower. So, yeah, I think you've got to compensate for all this stuff, undoubtedly, because otherwise you become absurdly over-focused on something which, as you said, you may be optimizing a part at the expense of the whole. And, I do wonder about that. Now, it is interesting if you go to Amazon, right? They visually try and limit choice. They don't really want you to get to page 2 because they know if you've looked at 60 toasters, you're actually probably not going to buy a toaster at all, or you're going to go off to Witch to research toasters because your mind is blown. So that's kind of, you know, that's an interesting kind of thing. But actually, having said that, test and learn is a great way of winning arguments with the finance function, where, you know, who will refuse to believe you. I mean, one of the problems, by the way, which you'll encounter, which is a weird bit of advice, which came to me from a guy who I think was in a big hotel chain. He said they changed something about their advertising approach, and they said it has an ROI of 35-1. And the fact, now this is really interesting. That doesn't surprise me. There are butterfly effects all over the place, right? But the finance guy said, that's rubbish. You don't get an ROI of 35-1. It's rubbish. He said, absolute rubbish. Go back and do your maths again, right? And the guy went back and did his maths and said, you're absolutely right. I was wrong. It's actually 37-1, right? And it suddenly occurred to me that if you're in this very narrow reductionist kind of mechanistic world, you see everything in terms of incremental improvement. Okay, you know, we've reduced our costs here and our supply chain has been streamlined over here. And roughly speaking, kind of pain and reward are sort of proportionate. And as a consequence of that kind of thinking, those people don't believe in butterfly effects. They don't believe there's an alchemical, magical kind of bullet that can actually solve a lot of your problems. I mean, something we did for British Airways cost £25,000 to do. It made them an extra £10 million in revenue, right? Okay. Now, finance people aren't thinking that way. They're thinking, you know, everything's only, we optimize a part and it has a proportional effect on the whole. But actually, in an interconnected system, there are these butterfly effects, and no one's looking for them. And then what's worse still, they don't believe them when they happen.
I wonder if it's different in distressed businesses, because for those, you either strip it really quickly and sell it on, or you have to take a risk and do something creative or behave differently. So when a business is operating really well, maybe you become more risk averse and it's more about the increment. But when a business is in disarray, then suddenly you have to make this large choice. You either strip it and sell it on, or you create significant change.
You could say, okay, all right, okay, P&G, who are kind of the sharpest, I don't know how to blow smoke up the competition, but they're kind of the smartest tools in the box quite often, okay? And you can argue that what they did with Old Spice was totally rational, which is, okay, we've got this product which is slowly dying. We have two choices, basically. We kill it, we let it slowly die. Well, three choices. We let it slowly die, we kill it off, or we take a bit of a bet. Okay. Now, if you take that bet, the ad campaign, which was highly eccentric and brilliant and actually rescued the brand, might have failed, you know, because that's just how it works. What if it fails? It kills off the brand a bit earlier. Who cares? We know it doesn't work. Okay, move on. We'll move, direct our attention somewhere else. Now, equally, if you're working on Tide, which is like 70% of the US laundry detergents market, you do want to be, you know, that you do want to be hyper cautious. You don't want to start doing wacky campaigns for Tide, which, you know, I don't know, you know, based on alienating Trump supporters or something like that. Okay, you really don't want to go there, right? Okay. And so there's a sort of, there's a whole question of upside downside asymmetry, which I learned from Nassim Taleb, you know. And there's a great book, Annie Duke's Thinking in Bets, which is all about, it's not about the probability that it happens, it's about the returns to it happening and what the counterfactual would have been. Okay. And so I think advertising agencies go, oh, you've got to be brave, you know, and you go, well, yeah, there are situations where you should be. And one of the things I'd love to do it with you, I'd love to do it with Nestle, I'd love to do it with P&G, is go and take two or three like really interesting dying brands which don't get any advertising support anymore, and where, you know, and just say, okay, can we actually do a bit of, can we bring this back from the dead? You know, I said to yesterday to a food company, look, take a failing brand and just rebrand it as an air fryer product and see what happens. You know, you can do that on the packaging, right? You know, and then everybody with an air fryer goes, well, I wouldn't normally have bought that, but if it's perfect for my new air fryer, I'll give it a go, you know, and, you know, who knows? Okay. So, you know, I think that kind of, I think it's always interesting that I think in Mark Ritson kind of, Byron Sharp terms, it's right to focus your really major brand building media effort on fewer brands. That totally buy that, okay? But actually, have a kind of Skunk Works, which takes a, I mean, Old Spice was kind of too good a brand to kill off in terms of residual shit. You know, you could have killed it off, you could have made the case, but give it a last gasp, give it a last chance at a hurrah.
I wonder. Yeah. If when you go through that stage, so say, for instance, you take a brand like Old Spice that is underperforming and then you reinvigorate it, that once you have reinvigorated it and it's a success, whether that then becomes about incrementality as well until that brand starts to diminish. It's almost like another cycle. You kind of save it, you get it into a really good place. But then when it's in a good place, you're really risk averse to take it any further. And then it just becomes about this incrementality. I wonder if that's like the circle of brands or the cycle of brands.
Because you had that thing, didn't you, where during COVID, in the end, it proved to be unnecessary. But a load of companies were basically given the brief, okay, can you manufacture a ventilator? Okay. Now, the process of developing a ventilator under normal circumstances would have stretched into decades, right? But the great thing was you had this sudden thing, which is we can only see two few. In other words, where you had a mode where being successful made you a hero and failing was just what was expected, okay? It completely changed the mindset where suddenly the speed at which things happened was just monumental. So, you know, until you got literally companies which generally developed a working ventilator within months rather than decades. And some of them probably would have worked and some of them wouldn't have done. But that does really interest me, which is that what we've created, I think, and I have to say, I kind of slightly blame people like Martin Sorrell for this bit, because they went around the world going, don't worry about Europe and the United States. They're all moribund. China's where all the growth's coming from. Just get into China and sell in China, okay? And what that did is, in the UK and the US and places, it created this scarcity mindset, which is, you know, it's a bit like, you know, the last days of the British Empire. Our job is to manage decline as painlessly as possible. And what you'll have noticed the same thing. When you first went into the media business, there was an opportunistic mindset. It was a mindset of abundance. Hey, we could do this and achieve that. And we've replaced it with this mindset of let's try and do less with less, or let's try and do the same with less, or let's try and do the same but shittier with slightly less. Okay, and that's the whole mindset which predominates in kind of Western Hemisphere business, I would argue. Well, I mean, European as well, business. And actually, this is, there's absolutely, you know, I mean, people are actually richer than, but what's ironic about this is, okay, we talk this doom, gloom, cost of living crisis, but people are appreciably richer than they were, right, back in 1988. But we're kind of acting as if everybody's poor. And, you know, I mean, okay, I'm not happy with the, by the way, just to be clear, I'm not happy with the way the wealth is distributed, but there is more of it around, right? You know, and yet we're behaving as though, you know, we're behaving as though it's kind of like the America during the Depression.
There was that book that came out a few years ago, isn't there? I think it was called Factfulness. And it basically took a load of stats and it demonstrated that despite the doom and gloom, and to be honest, I'm not totally convinced by all of this, but despite all of the doom and gloom, most countries and people are much financially better off and their health is much better, in a much better situation than it ever has been.
Yeah, poverty, real extreme poverty worldwide has been declining for years, for example. You know, people living in absolute states of poverty. But they even went to, like, the guy who was Danish, I think, was the guy. He was Scandinavian. And he actually went to people like partners at Goldman Sachs, and they said, well, we're people living in poverty under whatever it is, X dollars a day. Other numbers going up or down. And most of the partners at Goldman Sachs thought the numbers of people who are extremely poor were going up. Okay. And nearly all his basic good news story comes as a surprise to everybody who watches his presentation. And, you know, it really bothers me, this, because it basically puts the finance department in control of everything. And basically it means that what we achieve success by having people who can say no to almost everything. You know, everything that doesn't have a robust case, you basically say no to. And that wasn't how these businesses got started. In fact, what's really interesting is that the greatest period of probably of human innovation in history, okay, some people believe, was America during the 1930s. And it was because of the Depression. They thought, well, we're probably going to go bankrupt. Let's give it an Old Spice. Let's just have one last kind of tilt at the wheel, right? And, you know, out of that came, yeah, extraordinary. I mean, okay, it helped that you had electrification and stuff going on underneath. But it was an extraordinary period. You know, if you look at how cars improved, how, you know, I mean, that was probably in my grandmother's life. That was, you know, the 30s was like the period where shit got really good, you know, aeroplanes, etc.
Wasn't that Roosevelt? Didn't he introduce Plan B to make everything much better for everyone? It's kind of a redistribution of wealth in the United States.
Well, it was, yeah, I suppose it would have been, yeah, it would have been that era, wouldn't it? So post-Depression era. I have a more fundamental problem. I really worry about this, which is when we make all our products cheaper, okay, we're not actually making our consumers richer. We're just increasing property prices. Because it seems to me that property and accommodation just is this massive, great siphon which sucks up discretionary wealth, where most people buy the most expensive house they can, or in the case of people who rent, okay, our younger staff, accommodation and transportation is 50% of their after-tax expenditure. So we give them money, then it's tax. Let's be honest. You give us money, okay? Then there are a whole load of inefficiencies like property and overhead and finance and everything else. And then some of the money that Haleon has given us makes its way to a copywriter. And then the copywriter gets taxed, you know, marginally at 40%, okay? Well, I hope most, okay? And then 50% of what's left over goes in commuting costs and housing costs, okay? So all I'm doing, I think, if I make a product cheaper, is just making buy-to-let landlords and property owners richer at the expense of actually discretionary income. You know, I really, really worry about this, that there's this fundamental problem, unless we start taxing property, okay? There's this fundamental problem that the economy becomes mostly extractive, and the creative part of the economy that's actually generating value is actually a small... Now, one great thing about America in the 30s is I bet property was fucking dirt cheap, right? If you have a really good crash, okay, you know, and you see what happened. Silicon Valley started because property was cheap there. You know, it was in people's garages, right? Okay, and, you know, America's always had this advantage that you can live places really, really cheaply. And now, of course, Silicon Valley is absurd. You get these people paid a fortune. They're living... I mean, I never... New York, okay? I used to have these friends who are New Yorkers, and they worked at Ogilvy in New York. And they were really convinced, because they had this big shop job at Ogilvy, New York, they were really successful. And then you realize where they lived. It was like a pretty shitty apartment, and they had to get up and move their car across the street. Meanwhile, their parents like lived in Wisconsin, okay, and had a 5-car garage with 3 Corvettes, right, and, you know, like a telly in every room. But as far as these people in Ogilvy, New York, were concerned, their parents were complete losers, and they were successful. I was kind of going, I'm not sure you've quite thought this one through, to be absolutely honest.
It's weird, isn't it?
It's really, really weird. Yeah,
it's that paradox of success. For me, maybe that's your point. Maybe the reality is the world is getting richer and healthier, although I would argue it's also getting more unequal in certain parts. Like the richest get much richer and the poorer get much poorer. So maybe the distribution isn't fair, but as a whole, maybe it is richer and healthier. But I think in general, it's not helped by the news outlets that are very much focused on negative stories, and obviously because humans instinctively are more predisposed to the negative, we read it and we see that those things are happening, or there's a perception of those things are happening, so it reinforces this idea of doom and gloom when perhaps things aren't quite as bad as they appear.
So you know, you have this fundamental kind of economic depressive mentality. I think that's true. And actually, we've got to be really careful with environmentalism, because new forms of renewable energy can mean clean, fairly abundant, fairly cheap energy if we play it right, okay? And undoubtedly, we need to change patterns of consumption. I'm not denying that, because there are forms of consumption which create a bit of happiness, which are very, very bad for the planet. And there are forms of consumption which create a lot of happiness, which aren't bad for the planet at all. So we definitely need to reshape consumption.
So there's something on sustainability within this as well. Someone was telling me the other day, within the environmental industries, particularly when it comes to clothing and polyester clothing, there's a lot of companies that are using or recycling polyester. And that seems really good, right? Like, that's great that they're taking polyester and they're recycling it. However, recycled polyester can't be recycled again, apparently. So it can't be broken down. So there's this perception that we're doing the right thing, but actually by using creating recycled polyester, we're actually having a long-term negative impact on the environment. So there's this weird sort of dichotomy, like you're short-term, you're doing this thing to get rid of polyester and recycle it and doing the right thing. And then long term, it's actually having a negative impact.
And by the way, I mean, probably the answer is some, you know, in other words, probably the answer is to tax things for two reasons. One, the tax goes to something worthwhile, like social care and so on. But secondly, taxing activities which are what Jeff Bezos would call a one-way door, okay. In other words, when you're using exploiting a resource where the value lies in its scarcity, in a sense, Okay. The transition to energy taxes away from income taxes would seem a pretty sensible thing to do, actually, because then the costs would be reflected in what we buy. And what would actually happen, I think, is that costs aren't really just costs. They're also signals. Okay. So actually, it would doing that would change what's fashionable. Okay. And it would change the way people think about things.
That's totally true. I always thought that everyone thought exactly like me, and I couldn't understand when I was putting this sort of argument forward and no one was listening, or they just sort of shat on it. And then I realized that actually most people don't think like that and don't think like us. And actually most normal people have other things to worry about than the stuff that we do.
If I were in media planning, I'd always go, the first things to consider are radio, direct mail, brand partnerships, sonic branding, right? Because in my years in advertising, I never saw a radio campaign that didn't work, okay, right? It always works. But it's the first thing to get cut when the budget gets cut. And so it's got this, and I think a good media planner is basically, what was the greatest bit of media planning was HSBC buying all those jetways at airports, right? Because they spotted something which was totally underused as an advertising asset. And, that was just genius.
I remember the agency Naked, which I don't think exists anymore, but it did a really good campaign years and years ago. I think it was my favorite campaign ever. So basically, the Telegraph got a new sales director and they needed to drum up business from media buyers. So, it had good circulation, but it wasn't getting its fair share of revenue. So instead of running, a big campaign all over London, they did this really clever thing where they found out where print buyers went at lunchtime. And typically all agencies have a pub where certain buyers congregate. And essentially they put in lots and lots of the Telegraph in these pubs, and they had people reading the Telegraph, and they put up posters of the Telegraph, and the beer mats were of the Telegraph. And essentially what then happened is the print buyers assumed that everyone was reading the Telegraph, and therefore when they went back to the office after, five or six pints at lunchtime, they were calling up the Telegraph to get better rates and to try and buy space for their clients.
Beautiful. Beautiful stuff. Beautiful stuff. This has been fantastic fun.
It's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much, Rory.
You've been listening to On Brand with Alf and me, Rory Sutherland. If you want to do business with Haleon, as you should, or any other consumer health brand, contact the Alf Insight team on their website, which is www.alfinsight.com. That's alfinsight.com. And you can also find the link in the episode description. The series, as ever, is produced and expertly edited by Ultimate Content. And to make sure you receive the next episode, please do subscribe. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, give us a like and give us a share. So until next time, thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.